It's Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. I want to talk about Reds first baseman Joey Votto for a moment. There have been discussions lately as to Votto's contribution to his team, that perhaps he walks too much and doesn't drive in enough batters. That conversation is for a different time and probably a different show. I've never played the game professionally, and I'm not a stat genius, so I'm not going to sit here and talk about what skill or stat is the most valuable for a player to have. I know home runs are good, strikeouts are bad. The rest gets kind of muddy. But I do know one thing. The infield fly is a bad outcome. A looper might fall for a single, a grounder might find a hole, but popping one up to the infield never does anyone any good. The fielder might drop it, sure, but the infield fly rule is usually in effect, and the batter's out anyway. No runners advance, no runs are scored. It's a bad play. Let's get back to Votto. This is from August 13th, 2013, and he just hit a pop-up to the third baseman for the third out. It was not a good play. But it's still of note because this infield pop-up was the first one Votto had hit in the 2013 season. The first one. It took him about 4 months.
Pop-up on the infield. Donnie Murphy at third handles it. Reds leave a pair. They're stranded five.
Since 2008, Votto's first full season, he has hit 10 infield flies. Not averaged 10 a season. He's hit 10 total, over more than 3,500 plate appearances. Miguel Cabrera, widely considered the best hitter in the league, has hit 78, the most of any qualified batter since 2008. When Votto comes to bat, there is a 0.2% chance that he will pop up to the infield. He also happens to be doing this while slugging .543. For his career. This isn't the perfect way to measure a hitter. Again, Cabrera is the game's best, and he leads in the stat, but it's probably not something people look at very often. This doesn't make the conversations of newspaper columns or sports radio segments, because it's odd, and maybe not a good talking point. But just because it's overlooked, doesn't mean it's not important. From the Rip Sewell Memorial Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this is Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. We're talking about the overlooked, some things in baseball that, for some reason or another, don't get talked about very much. We'll start with Adam Dorowski, the proprietor of the Hall of Stats, who's been lobbying for one of the game's first stars, who finally just got some recognition. Then I'll talk to author Bill Mullins, who recently wrote a book about the Seattle Pilots. You know, that team that left town after one season. And Michael Clare gives his thoughts on a play that, though it usually defies logic, he loves anyway. The sacrifice bunt. All that plus the MVP of my heart. It's all coming up on Stealing Home. Let's play ball. Being a catcher has to be a tough job. If you watch even a moderate amount of baseball, you'll inevitably see a catcher take a foul tip off the mask, or a bouncing breaking ball to the chest, or maybe even the cup area. They get barreled into at home plate, get hit in the head with backswings, and have their knees routinely and systematically torn apart as they stand and crouch and stand and crouch. It's not a glamorous position. Rarely do catchers make defensive highlight reels. Very few catchers are the stars of their teams. They are very important to their teams, but often overlooked. So it was a bit of a victory for catchers everywhere when, in 2013, in a year when no contemporary players got voted in, a catcher finally made it to the Hall of Fame 123 years after his final game. James Deacon White was not only a very good catcher and third baseman, he was a pioneer in baseball. And so when the pre-integration era committee of the Hall of Fame decided to elect White, it brought smiles to those who had been championing his candidacy. One of those champions is Adam Dorowski.
Hi, I'm Adam Dorowski, and I'm the founder of the Hall of Stats at hallofstats.com. It's an alternate Hall of Fame populated by a mathematical formula.
And Adam is a pretty good authority on White's case for the Hall, because he's made these kinds of things a bit of a personal mission. The Hall of Stats takes a different approach to the Hall of Fame, trying to maybe find the players that don't get enough consideration. It strips away all of the ancillary things that go into a player's shot at the Hall and tries to boil it down to a simple, comparable number. Dorowski calls it Hall rating. It takes a player's performance during their peak and throughout their whole career and attempts to present a completely objective snapshot of a player's deservingness. It's an interesting system, and a system that really likes Deacon White. I talked to Adam about the Hall of Stats and his push for Deacon White's candidacy in the Hall of Fame.
The whole process got rolling really a couple of years ago with some articles that I was writing at Beyond the Box Score. Wins Above Replacement came out from Sean Smith. So this was the version at baseballprojection.com. And this was the first version of Wins Above Replacement that I saw that went back, like, way back to, like, 1871. So we could compare, you know, Albert Pujols with Ross Barnes if we wanted to. And now that we could do this, I started thinking, well, now that we've got a single number for every baseball player in history, we could just kind of rank them and, you know, populate a Hall of Fame that way. So that's kind of how it started. And then the Hall of Stats actually starts with WAR and wins above average from Baseball Reference. And it kind of adjusts it for things like shortened seasons in the 19th century and catching and relief pitching, just a few adjustments that I make there.
Yeah, and that's one thing. Maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more when we talk about Deacon White. But I think that's something that maybe people overlook, is that if you look just at counting stats, you know, even wins and home runs and RBI, those early players, they played shortened seasons and they played, they just didn't play as many games as everybody else. So maybe just the counting numbers overlook some of their achievements.
Right. The shortened seasons hurt the offensive players because they just didn't have as many games to you know, compile statistics. And it really helps the pitchers. You know, they didn't play every single day. So, you know, a pitcher is going to start, you know, three games in a week, but on the stat line, he's starting every single game for his team.
And so it is, now I don't know, while you were doing all this research and stuff, is this when you really got acquainted with Deacon White, or is he someone you had your eyes on previous to this?
That was really a few years ago, probably like 6 or 7 years ago now. When I first started looking into sabermetrics, I was a little bit obsessed with catchers and third basemen because they were kind of not only underpopulated in the Hall, but kind of strangely populated. Like the Hall of Stats, for example, agrees on only about half the third basemen in the Hall. So what's interesting is Deacon White is both a catcher and a third baseman. So I kept running into him as an overlooked player, both statistically and, you know, just for his contributions to the game.
And as you're looking into him, both for my interest and for the sake of a good radio story, what are some of the most interesting things that you found out about White?
Well, really the most interesting thing about White is he was a barehanded catcher. And that's just kind of unbelievable to even fathom. I mean, you know, they were throwing underhanded back then. But, you know, if you've seen fast pitch softball, you know that that's still not the easiest thing to catch with your bare hands. And so Deacon White was also the very first hitter in professional baseball. 1871, his team played the very first game, and he was the leadoff hitter, and he faced Bobby Matthews, and he doubled. So that was the very first at-bat and hit in major.
And he, if correct me if I'm wrong, but he was also kind of instrumental in sort of the impetus, the invention of the catcher's mask, no?
Right, the catcher's mask, the pitching windup. He's really credited with a lot of different things. He's also an early innovator of the curveball. Candy Cummings gets a lot of credit for inventing the curveball, but there's a lot of evidence that shows Deacon White was one of the main pioneers in that with that pitch, and he showed it to his brother, Will White, who actually ended up going on to win over 200 games himself.
So okay, so Deacon White wasn't a pitcher, but he kind of came up with this idea for a curveball and taught it to his brother.
Right.
Now White just recently got inducted into the Hall after a long, 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 long time of being ignored. Now we talked a little bit about how maybe his achievements were overseen a little bit or were glanced over, let's say, by, you know, things like shortened seasons and stuff. What do you think? I mean, you know, you're looking at the raw numbers. What do you think are some of the most impressive stats that Deacon White put up?
Well, he hit 312, which is impressive in any era. And he collected over 2,000 hits. The second one is the one that's more impressive because he did it in just over 1,500 games. And another way to look at it, too, is in the 1870s, so from 1871 to 1879, he absolutely dominated. He had a OPS plus of 151 for the entire decade. He only missed 8 games the entire decade. And he was a catcher. Not only a catcher, but he was a damn good one, too.
I'm just looking at his stats right now. I mean, he played till he was 42.
Yeah, that's another interesting thing.
122 games in his year 42 season. That's crazy.
Right. He actually played more games from age 35 on than he did before the age of 35 because of the shorter seasons when he was younger. So that really skews his career totals quite a bit. You know, a lot of his prime is not captured in those career totals.
Okay, so let's move back to the Hall of Stats a little bit. As you're compiling these numbers, I mean, there had to have been a few things that jumped out at you about a certain player or a certain era or you know, a certain pitcher or something where you thought, whoa, I would have never thought that this was true, you know, comparing it to everybody else. Is there something that jumps out at you in that regard?
And right, that's the interesting thing about WAR is it kind of makes some players look a little bit better than you realized. And that's why I think WAR is a great tool for not necessarily answering questions, but for asking questions. Like, why does Rick Rushel look like one of the best pitchers in history, really? And really, he's kind of Burt Blyleven light. He played for a long time. He had pretty good fielding independent numbers. And he just happened to play for the worst defenses of the 20th century. So that really brings down his numbers. And WAR, you know, takes those runs that were charged to him because of Dave Kingman in left field. And they you know, dock Kingman for them and give Rushel a little bit of credit. So that's why he starts to look really good, according to WAR.
And that's something I know people from different sides of the aisle, so to speak, have said. You know, you look at a guy and look at his wins above replacement and you say, well, yeah, but he played in an era where such and such, right? Well, he played in a home run heavy era or a power light era or something like that. And so they use that as kind of a discount to the guy's abilities, which I always thought was kind of unfair. Like if maybe he didn't hit as many home runs as, you know, Babe Ruth or something like that. But I mean, if he hit that much more than his competition, that has to count for something, right? I mean, it just seems like kind of a straw man argument to me.
I absolutely agree with that. And I think a good person to point to regarding that is Ross Barnes, who you recently covered. He was Babe Ruth before Babe Ruth came around. I mean, he didn't do it with home runs. He did it with, you know, fair foul hits and doubles and triples.
You're about a year into the Hall of Stats. The site has grown immensely, and you've done a really great job with it, I might add. Where do you see this going? Do you have any long-term projects in the future that you at least feel like sharing with people?
Well, there's a couple things that I'm still, you know, bouncing around in my head ways to figure it out. I mean, postseason would be a nice thing to get incorporated into it, and I've got some ideas about possible ways to cover that. And I still have this little thing in my mind. I want to figure out managers. I would love to figure out a Hall rating for managers. So that's something I've been working on a little bit too.
That's really interesting. Well, actually, both of those are interesting because certainly postseason is something that people pay a lot of attention to, and rightfully so. I mean, you know, postseason performance isn't something to sneeze at, but you also have to kind of be in the right situation. Whereas managers, that's totally about being in the right situation, right? I mean, how much stock do you put into locally here, the Twins, right? El Stinko for the last, 3.5 years? And people are starting to call for Ron Gardenhire's head. But if you look at the roster that he's been given, I mean, geez, you know, I can't imagine, you know, a whole lot of human effort can go into turning that roster into something reasonable. Do you put a lot of stock into managers, or is that still something you're trying to shake out?
I'm really still trying to shake it out here. I mean, Ron Gardenhire, actually, I did a study a while back called Manager Wins Above Expectancy. Basically, it took a team's pith record, so the expected record based on their runs scored, and it looked at how much a manager overperformed or underperformed. And then I also looked at the total WAR for that manager's players and checked how much they over or underperformed. And Gardenhire actually ranks pretty well. He ranks 38.8 is his total wins above expectancy, which is in the top 20 all time.
Interesting. Interesting. So that's something, yeah, I always thought that. And what about postseason? I mean, is that people point to guys like Mariano Rivera, and he's unfair because he could have not pitched a postseason game in his life and still be in the Hall. But, I mean, is that something that you put stock in, or is that something maybe that's just kind of exists in its own separate section?
Well, I used win probability added for a version of for a postseason component for this a while back. This was actually before the Hall of Stats. And while it was kind of nice that it actually, you know, gave credit to the wins that they actually helped produce, also, it's based incredibly on leverage. So players like Mariano Rivera were just absolutely through the roof. So that's one thing that led me to trying to figure out a better way to do it, trying to look more at a wins above replacement approach rather than a win probability approach.
Well, Adam, I thank you so much for joining me on Stealing Home. You're doing really great work over there at the Hall of Stats, and I look forward to reading future editions and future revelations that you guys come up with over there.
Well, thank you very much.
Adam Dorowski's Alternative Baseball Hall of Fame can be found at hallofstats.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at baseballtwit. It's Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. My guest is author and historian Bill Mullins. Bill was a presenter at this most recent Sabre convention, and I got a chance to hear him speak about the Seattle Pilots, a bit of a forgotten franchise, due mostly to the fact that they only existed for 1 year. There are countless baseball teams from the early days that came and went, failed attempts by businessmen who were looking to capitalize on a new American craze. But the Pilots came to be in 1977 what we still consider to be the modern era of the game. The story of the Pilots is one wrapped in politics, posturing, and poor planning. And Bill lays out all the details very well in his book, Becoming Big League, Seattle, the Pilots, and Stadium Politics. I talked to Bill about his book and his experiences researching and living with the Seattle Pilots. Are you from the Pacific Northwest kind of most of your life? Is that where you hail from?
Well, a portion of my life, I lived in the Pacific Northwest. I did my graduate work, my MA and my PhD at the University of Washington, and we both fell in love with the Pacific Northwest. So though we spent 20 years in Oklahoma, we had always planned to come back to the Pacific Northwest when we retired.
And were you in that area around the time of the Pilots, or is that something that you stumbled upon later?
No, I actually started graduate school in 1968, so I was here in 1969, and actually went to a couple of Pilots games.
Were you excited? I don't know how much exposure you had to at least Major League Baseball growing up, but were you excited to have, or were you excited, you know, at the prospect of having a Major League team in your city?
Well, I've been a baseball fan for almost all of my life, since at least I was 8 years old. And I had lived in Southern California, so I had attended a number of Dodger games, but I thought it was really great coming to the Pacific Northwest and having a baseball team right in town. So that was a good thing, and I took advantage of it a little bit while I was here.
Do you remember, I mean, you've done so much research on it now, but do you remember kind of the political wheelings and dealings that were going on as it was happening when you were in that city?
Well, I don't think I had any clue that the team was in as much trouble as it was. I was really surprised when there was talk about it moving during the off season. But I do remember the Forward Thrust voting campaign to fund the Kingdome. That occurred while I was in the Pacific Northwest, and I definitely remember that election and people beating the drum to get enough votes to build the Kingdome.
So let's fast forward a bit. When did you become more interested in the history of the Pilots, and when did you decide to really devote a lot of your time and energy into researching everything that went into that team?
Well, it was really when we were beginning to contemplate retirement, and I figured I needed something to do. I needed some kind of a project. And so even in Oklahoma, I began doing a little bit of research, mainly just to find out what had been done on the Pilots. And at that time, there was only one book. There's since been another book besides mine, but just one book. And it was mainly about ball playing on the field. And what I figured was that there was a story there that was about the business of baseball. And so that's what I was really after. And it turned out there was much more of a story than I realized.
I've done, you know, cursory research just as a hobby. I can't imagine doing enough to constitute, you know, all the information that goes into a book. what kind of, I mean, can you just kind of glaze over the process for us of what goes into writing a research book like this?
Sure. I'm a historian, so I guess I've been trained in that direction. But what I decided to do first was to read through the newspapers to kind of just get the story in mind. And that's where it began to expand when I realized that it was a story not just about baseball team, not just about front office, but there was a story about the whole city and the story about stadium building. And then there were archives that were available. There were the bankruptcy archives that were available in Seattle. There was the trial transcript that was available to the north of us, about an hour and a half in a federal or a state repository. The city had a whole batch of material that I was able to go through, and King County, where Seattle is located, also had a good deal. So there was a lot of archival research that I was able to do, and I also I looked at a lot of books on baseball and on Seattle to try to get as rich an understanding of the background that I could bring in when it was appropriate as I was writing.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, looking at history, I'm going to still call this recent history, you know, on the grand timeline of things.
It's
still
recent for me because I lived through it.
Exactly. Exactly. So you said you relied, at least in part, on newspaper reports. Now, we all kind of know that sometimes newspaper writers, reporters, columnists can kind of skew things in their own way. They can kind of address or present a story kind of through their own eyes. Is this something that you saw? Did you see a little maybe one side of the coin versus the other in the way that writers wrote about the coming of this team?
Well, I think there were two things going on. Then there were two newspapers in Seattle, the Seattle Times and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and they definitely competed against one another, and they had different focuses. And so I took that into account. But I think sports writers, more than reporters and even columnists, kind of show their personality to a great degree. And so I got to know each one of the reporters, the sports editors, the couple of beat writers, and so on. And so I always looked at what they wrote, looking through the lens of what I felt about them or the personality they had. So there was one fellow, Hi Zimmerman, who was the beat writer for the Times, and he was a really hard-driving fellow and always beating the drum to get a baseball team or to keep the baseball team. And so it was always interesting to read Hi Zimmerman because he would be the most likely over the top about something. He wrote the column, "Won't You Go Home, Bill Daley," which just chewed out the absentee owner from Cleveland, William Daley. And it's not surprising that he's the one who did it.
It's Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. And I'm talking with Bill Mullins, an author and historian whose latest book on the Seattle Pilots is called Becoming Big League, Seattle, the Pilots, and Stadium Politics. Without getting too deep into it, we'll skip over the entrance of the Pilots. We'll leave that for the listeners to grab your book and look that up. Can you give us a little bit of the background as to what happened? I mean, it almost, from what I've read so far, it almost happened almost instantaneously at the start of the season, where the decline, the decay of the Pilots had already begun. I know that in your Sabre presentation, you mentioned a lot of factors that went into the demise of the Pilots. Can you talk about maybe a few of the big ones that led to them eventually moving to Milwaukee?
Well, I think the particular ones, I might start with Seattle itself, whether Seattle was really ready for Major League Baseball. Both the fans and the city leaders just weren't that excited, I think, about having a major league team. And so that's where the title of the book comes, is Becoming Big League, because I trace Seattle from really about 1962 through the coming of the Mariners in 1976. Their first season was 1977. And so there's the city. There's the ownership. They priced the tickets too high. Right off the bat, it was clear that they were too high. I think they thought they had a captive audience that wouldn't spend their money on anything else, and they were willing to pay a premium for Major League Baseball, and they were absolutely wrong. Attendance ended up being about 678,000, and that wasn't even break even. And I think that owed a lot to pricing the tickets too high. But the one major thing was there wasn't local money in the ownership. The Sorianos, who tended to the day-to-day business, were only minority owners, part owners of the Pilots. The primary owner was William Daley, who lived in Cleveland. And Daley had guaranteed that he would underwrite the club perhaps up to even $8 million. And he reneged on that guarantee. And I think it was easier for him to do that because he was living in Cleveland rather than in Seattle. And so absentee ownership and a fairly stingy ownership was a major, major problem.
And it was interesting to me to hear about kind of the rush of the American League owners who ended up voting on this. It was quite an upswell in a really short amount of time where they decided that this city doesn't get this team anymore, and we're moving this city. It just seemed like all those parts were moving so fast to make such a big decision.
Well, one of the things I say in the book is that the American League owners bumble through the story, and they bumble from 1967 when the franchise was granted to the spring of 1970 when the Pilots moved to Milwaukee to become the Brewers. It just doesn't seem like the owners make very wise decisions. I think they jumped for the city because they saw an open space on the map, but a city that probably, as I said, wasn't really ready for Major League Baseball. And then they didn't want the team to move. It was really an embarrassment to have a Major League Baseball team stay only 1 year in the city, and they knew that they were going to get a lot of political pressure from the two senators from Washington, who were then long-tenured and really powerful, Warren Magnuson and Scoop Jackson. And so they did their best to keep the team from moving, but their best was hardly good enough. And so they just kind of made mistakes all along the way. I don't think they were very thoughtful, and I'm not sure how adept they were really as businessmen.
And you, I mean, a lot of the book revolves around, you know, if Seattle was ready for a team. If I'm not mistaken, there were a couple other chances for Seattle to get a team. I think the Indians were perhaps looking into relocating there at some point. Am I wrong about that?
That's correct.
And I think Charlie Finley also had something. Yeah. Maybe he was always scheming to move his team, so maybe that's not the best example. But there were other attempts to move or create teams in Seattle. Do you think if one of those others had gone through, things would have been different, or do you think it was maybe kind of doomed from the beginning?
I think if Seattle would have had an established team, there would have been a much better chance for that team to have stayed over a long term. But again, when Gabe Paul came to town thinking about moving the Indians, and then Charlie Finley 3 or 4 years later came, there wasn't much of a positive response on the part, certainly, of the political leaders who told Gabe Paul that they thought Seattle wasn't really ready for a team for at least another 5 years. And the negotiations with Finley didn't go well, partly because he was Charlie Finley. He demanded an out. If the voters didn't vote for positively for the Kingdome, he wanted an opportunity to move, after a year. And I think nobody would have gone for that.
I want to talk a little bit about Six Stadium. That was the home for the Rainiers, I believe.
That's right.
Okay.
And yeah, they call themselves different things, but Rainiers is the main name.
And that was the stadium that the Pilots had planned on using as their ballpark. Now, it was the seating capacity was well under what the American League wanted for a major league team. And so they had to do a lot of quick and seemingly kind of cheap renovations that always didn't go so well. You said that you saw a few Pilots games. Can you kind of explain what Six Stadium was like to watch a baseball game in?
Well, pretty clearly it was a minor league ballpark, and it had the advantages and disadvantages of that. When the Rainiers were playing there, there were 11,000 seats or so, and they upgraded that to 25,000 seats, and the American League really wanted 30,000. But I sat out in the bleachers, and I felt like I was pretty close to the field, especially compared to Dodger Stadium. And then sat in the outfield a little bit closer to the fences, and I could yell out easily and know that the players were hearing me. And so that was the advantage, is there were no seats that were very far away from the action. But it really was a small park. The bleachers were just boards with no backs, and it got kind of tiring after a while to sit out there and watch baseball.
And the Pilots had the option to use the expansion draft to game players, and something you mentioned a little bit is that maybe they didn't seek out the best players. They were looking maybe for names, bigger names that would draw crowds, but maybe these players weren't necessarily as good as they used to be. Did you have any Pilots that you held dear that you cheered for?
Surely, as a Dodger fan, Tommy Davis was a a favorite. You know, Tommy Davis, I think, would have been a Hall of Famer had he not broken his ankle. So that was a real favorite. Boy, besides that, maybe Don Mincher. In Seattle, probably the most popular of the pilots was the shortstop, Ray Oyler. And that was actually because the radio station that carried pilot broadcast, there was a DJ in the morning who was kind of irreverent, and he began making fun of Ray Oyler and started the Ray Oyler fan club because, well, Ray Oyler just couldn't hit. He was perpetually below the Mendoza line. It took off, and Ray Oyler ended up being one of the grand marshals for the local celebration called Seafair.
And so, fast forwarding a little bit, the pilots leave town. The Kingdom is built to facilitate the expansion Seattle Seahawks, which eventually brings another baseball team to Seattle. Did you feel comforted when Seattle finally got a team to stay?
Sure. Yeah, we were still living in the region, not in Seattle, and so we were able to drive in to see the Mariners play, and that was a nice thing.
Well, it's such an interesting story. The story of the Pilots. I mean, 40 years ago, give or take, seems like a long time, but the fact that a team can come to a city and then take off within a year is such an interesting story, and your book is really great. It outlines it so well, and everybody should really pick it up. Bill, thank you so much for joining me on Stealing Home.
Well, thanks. I enjoyed talking with you.
Bill Mullen's latest book, Becoming Big League, Seattle, the Pilots, and Stadium Politics, is available wherever fine books are sold. If you travel in certain circles, or even just visit said circles from time to time to see how the other half lives, you've witnessed discussions about the sacrifice bunt. Some people think it's stupid. Writer Michael Clare thinks it's stupid, but he just can't help loving it anyway.
I'm about to tell you something so shocking, so disgusting, so foul and immoral, your opinion of me will be forever changed. But I have to say it. I have to let you all know my true feelings. I love the sacrifice bunt. There, I said it. It's out there. And no, I'm not an idiot. I've seen Tango Tiger's charts and Beyond the Box Scores graphs. I've traveled to psychics and thought conversion centers to try and sway me of this emotion. My brain knows that 99% of the time, the sacrifice bunt is the exact worst thing a ball club can do. If they want to score runs and win baseball games, that is. I get that. I do. But there are plenty of things people love that are bad for us, and no one, outside of our doctors and significant others, trouble us for. Alcohol, red meat, the musical stylings of Harry Connick Jr. None of those make us better, prepare us for a brighter, more successful future, but it's fine to love those in moderation. But the sacrifice bunt, in all of its unselfish glory? That's a step too far. Sure, I would feel differently if I was a general manager or manager, or perhaps even just an intern in the baseball operations department. I would see a sacrifice in the top of the fourth inning and scream, cry, and pound against the walls, wondering why in God's name I was being punished this way. Fortunately, for a variety of reasons, I'm in none of those positions. My life doesn't change at all if my team wins or loses. I can sit back and enjoy the sacrifice bunt simply for its aesthetic beauty, just as I can a fluttering knuckleball or Willie Mopeña highlight. Our society values sacrifice. The man who leaps into the rushing river to save a child he's never even met and probably wouldn't like. The mother who works three jobs to put her children through college just in time for the economy to collapse, making that degree worthless. The rich billionaire who gives up his nights and wrecks his body, exacting his own brand of street justice. These are our heroes. And baseball's not immune from that. Traditionally, the act of sacrifice was valued so much that we don't penalize the player for doing it. Oh, you are just giving yourself up to move your teammate 90 feet? Your betting average shall remain impugned. Of course, if the scorer even suspects that you, as the batter, were attempting to move the runner over and get yourself on base at the same time, your hubris will be punished to the tune of an 0 for 1. Baseball is ostensibly a team game, but really it's a matter of a zillion individual matchups that, in the end, come together to make a complete form. But when a batter squares up and pushes one onto the grass, he's saying, no, the I is less than the us, the greater good is more important, the we is the best I can aspire to. Which, maybe that's why people hate the sacrifice so much. It's not because it's costing your team runs on the board and a chance at victory. It's because it's a small piece of socialism that has snuck its way into America. W.E.B. Du Bois was probably a huge fan of the bunt. Soon, I'm sure, we'll see signs reading, "Down with Obamacare and the sacrifice bunt." And if I understood the back of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Zen is all about living in the moment, existing for the very second that you're in. And what's more Zen than a bunt? A player looking only to softly deaden the ball on the infield grass, thinking only about that inning, that run, that play, not worrying about what the score will be later in the game? Playing for one run means playing with mindfulness. In 1917, Ray Chapman set the record for most sacrifice bunts in a season with 67. He also hit 302, 370, 409 for an OPS plus of 131 while playing shortstop for the Cleveland Indians. Chapman would lead the league in sacrifices two other times, also leading the league in walks and runs in 1918. Sadly, Chapman's career ended tragically when, at the age of 29, he was hit by a pitch by Carl Mays, took a few steps, and collapsed, dying 12 hours later in a New York hospital. Had his career continued, he quite possibly would have finished with the career lead in sacrifice bunts instead of Eddie Collins, who collected 512 over 25 seasons. But the game has changed, and, for better or worse, we no longer see good shortstops laying down 60-plus bunts a season. The active leader is Juan Pierre with 165, being the last player to even get 20 in a season when he accomplished the feat in 2007. In second place is Roy Oswalt, a pitcher who's never even had 90 plate appearances in a season. But there's still one place left to go, one shrine left to visit if you find nothing more sublime than a deadened ball moving a runner from first to second. And that's Japan. Why, over there, six players already have more than 20 bunts this season. None more than, and I apologize for butchering his name, Kenta Imamiya's 44 sacrifices. The last major leaguer with 30 was Jay Bell in 1991. And even though offense is back to its 1970s levels, it's doubtful we'll ever see the bunt return to its once fabled position. The game has changed. The fans no longer chant, "Bunt! Bunt! Give me the bunt!" like I imagine they once did. The only people extolling the virtue of the bunt, besides myself, are aged men on the radio saying things like, "You can give me all the charts you want, but do you have a chart for the human heart?" If anything, teams are bunting worse than ever. Patrick Dubuque of Lookout Landing studied the bunt and discovered that while position players are bunting less than ever, pitchers are almost exclusively bunting, giving away its advantage by easily forecasting to the defense what the offense plans to do. Because, if anything, the bunt is not a weapon, but a subtle tool. A trick done in plain sight, forcing the defense to creep up and wonder if it will be laid down or chopped at, resulting in a screaming liner from only 50 feet away. And sure, bunts aren't remembered like home runs or grounders that trickle between the legs, but that doesn't mean they're any less important. After all, Jake Taylor's bunt to score Willie Mays Hayes saved an entire franchise. And if the bunt is good enough to save a team featuring Tom Berenger and Wesley Snipes, well, it's good enough for me. Taylor bunt! Shit.
Michael Clare is a writer from Los Angeles, California. You can follow his baseball writing at oldtimefamilybaseball.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at ClareBearAttack. To end every show, I like to look at someone who, for reasons on the field or off, deserve a little love. It's the MVP of my heart. Zach Greinke, is a good pitcher. Quite a good pitcher, actually, which is why the Dodgers signed him to a six-year, $147 million contract in the 2013 offseason. He's been good this season, posting his lowest ERA since 2008, even though he missed a month after Carlos Quinton broke his clavicle. His pitching isn't getting much attention this season, since he happens to be on the same staff as Clayton Kershaw, who has been absolutely otherworldly this year. But there's another facet of Greinke's game that is being overlooked. His hitting. Pitchers at the plate are often accompanied with some snickers and smirks. If there is any situation a manager can ask a pitcher to bunt, he will. Pitchers just aren't good hitters. They have, you know, other stuff to worry about. But Greinke always liked hitting. He didn't even pitch until high school. He was an infielder with a good deal of power. And though he's had limited at-bats this year, he's turning in quite a season at the plate. If you look at all the batters with at least 60 plate appearances this year, Greinke leads the Dodgers with a .429 on base percentage, is second in average at .347, and third in weighted on base average at .370. That's higher than Adrian Gonzalez, Andre Ethier, Carl Crawford, AJ Ellis, and Matt Kemp. According to Fangraphs, Greinke is worth 1.1 wins above replacement, just as a hitter. This could all be attributed to a small sample size, but that doesn't make it any less fun to watch. We marvel at a pitcher if he's able to bloop a single. Greinke is hitting for power. He hasn't hit a homer yet, though he has three on his career. But there's still time. The pitcher hitting is usually viewed as a good time to take a bathroom break or get a beer. Interesting things aren't usually on the way. Greinke is making pitcher at-bats must-see television. The Dodgers are going to make the playoffs this year, maybe even the World Series. And when they do, I hope more people get to see Greinke swing the bat. Because, at least this year, he's really good at it. And for flying under the radar, for actually being a productive hitter from the ninth spot on the lineup card, Zach Greinke is the MVP of my heart. Stealing Home is hosted and produced by me, David Temple. A big thanks to Adam Dorowski, Bill Mullins, and Michael Clare. You can check out show notes for this episode and all other episodes at stealinghome.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/stealinghomeradio and follow us on Twitter at stealinghomeorg. I'm David Temple. We'll see you next time on Stealing Home.